Chapter 9. The word desertion. Thus the taste of innocent adventure may be made bitter to the palate. The part of the inexplicable should be allowed for in appraising the conduct of men in a world where no explanation is final. No charge of faithlessness ought to be lightly uttered. The appearances of this perishable life are deceptive like everything that falls under the judgment of our imperfect senses. The inner voice may remain true enough in its secret counsel. The fidelity to a special tradition may last through the events of an unrelated existence, following faithfully to the traced way of an inexplicable impulse. It would take too long to explain the intimate alliance of contradictions in human nature which makes love itself wear at times the desperate shape of betrayal. And perhaps there is no possible explanation. Indulgence, as somebody said, is the most intelligent of all the virtues. I venture to think that it is one of the least common, if not the most uncommon of all. I would not imply by this that men are foolish, or even most men. Far from it. The barber and the priest, backed by the whole opinion of the village, condemned justly the conduct of the ingenious Hidalgo who, sallying forth from his native place, broke the head of the muleteer, put to death a flock of inoffensive sheep, and went through very doleful experiences in a certain stable. God forbid that an unworthy churl should escape merited censure by hanging onto the stirrup leather of the sublime caballero. His was a very noble, a very unselfish fantasy, fit for nothing except to raise the envy of baser mortals. But there is more than one aspect to the charm of that exalted and dangerous figure. He, too, had his frailties. After reading so many romances, he desired naively to escape with his very body from the intolerable reality of things. He wished to meet eye to eye the valorous giant Brandabarbran, lord of Arabia, whose armor is made of the skin of a dragon, and whose shield, strapped to his arm, is the gate of a fortified city. O amiable and natural weakness! O blessed simplicity of a gentle heart without guile! Who would not succumb to such a consoling temptation? Nevertheless, it was a form of self-indulgence, and the ingenious Hidalgo of La Mancha was not a good citizen. The priest and the barber were not unreasonable in their strictures. Without going so far as the old King Louis Philippe, who used to say in his exile, "The people are never in fault," one may admit that there must be some righteousness in the ascent of a whole village. Mad! Mad! He who kept in pious meditation the ritual vigil of arms by the well of Annan and knelt reverently, to be knighted at daybreak by the fat, sly rogue of a landlord, has come very near perfection. He rides forth, his head encircled by a halo, the patron saint of all lives spoiled or saved by the irresistible grace of imagination. But he was not a good citizen. Perhaps that and nothing else was meant by the well-remembered exclamation of my tutor. It was in the jolly year 1873, the very last year in which I have had a jolly holiday. There have been idle years afterwards, jolly enough in a way, and not altogether without their lesson, but this year of which I speak was the year of my last schoolboy holiday. There are other reasons why I should remember that year, but they are too long to state formally in this place. Moreover, they have nothing to do with that holiday. What has to do with the holiday is that before the day on which the remark was made, we had seen Vienna, the Upper Danube, Munich, the Falls of the Rhine, the Lake of Constance. In fact, it was a memorable holiday of travel. Of late we had been tramping slowly up the valley of the Reuss. It was a delightful time. It was much more like a stroll than a tramp. Landing from a Lake of Lucerne steamer in Fluelen, we found ourselves at the end of the second day, with the dusk overtaking our leisurely footsteps, a little way beyond Haspenthal. This is not the day on which the remark was made. In the shadows of the deep valley, and with the habitations of men left some way behind, our thoughts ran not upon the ethics of conduct, but upon the simpler human problem of shelter and food. There did not seem anything of the kind in sight, and we were thinking of turning back, when suddenly at a bend of the road we came upon a building, ghostly in the twilight. At that time the work on the St. Gothard Tunnel was going on, and that magnificent enterprise of Berlin was directly responsible for the unexpected building, standing all alone upon the very roots of the mountains. It was long, though not big at all. It was low. It was built of boards, without ornamentation, in Baroque hut style, with the white window frames quite flush with the yellow face of its plain front. And yet it was an hotel. It had even a name which I have forgotten. But there was no gold-laced doorkeeper at its humble door. A plain but vigorous servant girl answered our inquiries. Then a man and woman who owned the place appeared. It was clear that no travelers were expected, or perhaps even desired, in this strange hostelry, which in its severe style resembled the house which surmounts the unseaworthy-looking hulls of the toy Noah's Arks, the universal possession of European childhood. However, its roof was not hinged, and it was not full to the brim of slab-sided and painted animals of wood. Even the live tourist animal was nowhere in evidence. We had something to eat in a long, narrow room at one end of a long, narrow table, which, to my tired perception, and to my sleepy eyes, seemed as if it would tilt up like a seesaw plank, since there was no one at the other end, to balance it against our two moldy and travel-stained figures. Then we hastened upstairs, to bed in a room smelling of pine planks, and I was fast asleep before my head touched the pillow. In the morning my tutor, he was a student of the Krakow University, woke me up early, and as we were dressing remarked, "There seems to be a lot of people staying in this hotel. I have heard a noise of talking up till 11 o'clock." This statement surprised me. I had heard no noise whatever, having slept like a top. We went downstairs into the long and narrow dining room with its long and narrow table. There were two rows of plates on it. At one of the many uncurtained windows stood a tall bony man with a bald head set off by a bunch of black hair above each ear, and with a long black beard. He glanced up from the paper he was reading, and seemed genuinely astonished at our intrusion. By and by more men came in. Not one of them looked like a tourist. Not a single woman appeared. These men seemed to know each other with some intimacy, but I cannot say they were a very talkative lot. The bald-headed man sat down gravely at the head of the table. It all had the air of a family party. By and by, from one of the vigorous servant girls in national costume, we discovered that the place was really a boarding house for some English engineers engaged at the works of the St. Gothard Tunnel. And I could listen my fill to the sounds of the English language, as far as it is used at a breakfast table by men who do not believe in wasting many words on the mere amenities of life. This was my first contact with British mankind apart from the tourist kind seen in the hotels of Zurich and Lucerne, the kind which has no real existence in a workaday world. I know now that the bald-headed man spoke with a strong Scotch accent. I have met many of his kind since, both ashore and afloat. The second engineer of the steamer Avis, for instance, ought to have been his twin brother. I cannot help thinking that he really was, though for some reasons of his own he assured me that he never had a twin brother. Anyway, the deliberate bald-headed Scot with the coal black beard appeared to my boyish eyes a very romantic and mysterious person. We slipped out unnoticed. Our mapped-out route led over the Furka Pass towards the Rhone Glacier, with the further intention of following down the trend of the Hasli Valley. The sun was already declining when we found ourselves on the top of the pass, and the remark alluded to was presently uttered. We sat down by the side of the road, to continue the argument begun half a mile or so before. I am certain it was an argument, because I remember perfectly how my tutor argued, and how without the power of reply I listened with my eyes fixed obstinately on the ground. A stir on the road made me look up, and then I saw my unforgettable Englishman. There are acquaintances of later years, familiars, shipmates, whom I remember less clearly. He marched rapidly towards the east, attended by a hangdog Swiss guide, with the mien of an ardent and fearless traveler. He was clad in a knickerbocker suit, but as at the same time he wore short socks under his laced boots, for reasons which, whether hygienic or conscientious, were surely imaginative. His calves exposed to the public gaze, and to the tonic air of high altitudes, dazzled the beholder by the splendor of their marble-like condition, and their rich tone of young ivory. He was the leader of a small caravan. The light of a headlong, exalted satisfaction with the world of men, and the scenery of mountains illumined his clean-cut, very red face, his short, silver-white whiskers, his innocently eager and triumphant eyes. In passing he cast a glance of kindly curiosity, and a friendly gleam of big, sound, shiny teeth towards the man and the boy sitting like moldy tramps by the roadside, with a modest knapsack lying at their feet. His white calves twinkled sturdily, the uncouth Swiss guide with a surly mouth stalked like an unwilling bear at his elbow. A small train of three mules followed in single file the lead of this inspiring enthusiast. Two ladies rode past one behind the other, but from the way they sat I saw only their calm, uniform backs, and the long ends of blue veils hanging behind far down over their identical hat brims. His two daughters surely. An industrious luggage mule, with unstarched ears and guarded by a slouching, sallow driver, brought up the rear. My tutor, after pausing for a look and a faint smile, resumed his earnest argument. I tell you it was a memorable year. One does not meet such an Englishman twice in a lifetime. Was he in the mystic ordering of common events the ambassador of my future, sent out to turn the scale at a critical moment on the top of an alpine pass, with the peaks of the Bernese Oberland for mute and solemn witnesses? His glance, his smile, the unextinguishable and comic ardor of his striving forward appearance helped me to pull myself together. It must be stated, that on that day and in the exhilarating atmosphere of that elevated spot I had been feeling utterly crushed. It was the year in which I had first spoken aloud of my desire to go to sea. At first like those sounds that, ranging outside the scale to which men's ears are attuned, remain inaudible to our sense of hearing, this declaration passed unperceived. It was as if it had not been. Later on, by trying various tones I managed to arouse here and there a surprised momentary attention. The hat was that funny noise? Sort of inquiry. Later on it was, did you hear what that boy said? What an extraordinary outbreak. Presently a wave of scandalized astonishment. It could not have been greater if I had announced the intention of entering a Carthusian monastery, ebbing out of the educational and academical town of Krakow spread itself over several provinces. It spread itself shallow but far-reaching. It stirred up a mass of remonstrance, indignation, pitying wonder, bitter irony and downright chaff. I could hardly breathe under its weight, and certainly had no words for an answer. People wondered what Mr. T. B.B. would do now with his worrying nephew, and, I dare say, hoped kindly that he would make short work of my nonsense. What he did, was to come down all the way from Ukraine, to have it out with me, and to judge by himself, unprejudiced, impartial and just, taking his stand on the ground of wisdom and affection. As far as is possible for a boy whose power of expression is still unformed, I opened the secret of my thoughts to him, and he in return allowed me a glimpse into his mind and heart, the first glimpse of an inexhaustible and noble treasure of clear thought and warm feeling, which through life was to be mine to draw upon with a never-deceived love and confidence. Practically, after several exhaustive conversations, he concluded that he would not have me later on reproach him for having spoiled my life by an unconditional opposition. But I must take time for serious reflection. And I must not only think of myself but of others, weigh the claims of affection and conscience against my own sincerity of purpose. Think well what it all means in the larger issues, my boy, he exhorted me finally with special friendliness. And in the meantime try to get the best place you can at the yearly examinations. The scholastic year came to an end. I took a fairly good place at the exams. which for me, for certain reasons, happened to be a more difficult task than for other boys. In that respect, I could enter with a good conscience upon that holiday which was like a long visit poor Prender Conge of the mainland of old Europe I was to see so little of for the next 24 years. Such, however, was not the avowed purpose of that tour. It was rather, I suspect, planned in order to distract and occupy my thoughts in other directions. Nothing had been said for months of my going to sea. But my attachment to my young tutor and his influence over me were so well known that he must have received a confidential mission to talk me out of my romantic folly. It was an excellently appropriate arrangement, as neither he nor I had ever had a single glimpse of the sea in our lives. That was to come by and by for both of us in Venice, from the outer shore of Lido. Meantime, he had taken his mission to heart so well that I began to feel crushed before we reached Zurich. He argued in railway trains, in lake steamboats. He had argued away for me the obligatory sunrise on the Rhine, by Jove! Of his devotion to his unworthy pupil there can be no doubt. He had proved it already by 2 years of unremitting and arduous care. I could not hate him. But he had been crushing me slowly, and when he started to argue on the top of the fir coppice he was perhaps nearer a success than either he or I imagined. I listened to him in despairing silence, feeling that ghostly, unrealized and desired sea of my dreams escape from the unnerved grip of my will. The enthusiastic old Englishman had passed and the argument went on. What reward could I expect from such a life at the end of my years, either in ambition, honor or conscience? An unanswerable question. But I felt no longer crushed. Then our eyes met and a genuine emotion was visible in his as well as in mine. The end came all at once. He picked up the knapsack suddenly and got onto his feet. You are an incorrigible hopeless Don Quixote. That's what you are. I was surprised. I was only 15, and did not know what he meant exactly. But I felt vaguely flattered at the name of the immortal knight turning up in connection with my own folly, as some people would call it to my face. Alas! I don't think there was anything to be proud of. Mine was not the stuff the protectors of forlorn damsels, the redressers of this world's wrongs are made of, and my tutor was the man to know that best. Therein, in his indignation, he was superior to the barber and the priest, when he flung at me an honored name like a reproach. I walked behind him for full 5 minutes, then without looking back he stopped. The shadows of distant peaks were lengthening over the fir coppice. When I came up to him, he turned to me, and in full view of the Finster Arhorn, with his band of giant brothers rearing their monstrous heads against a brilliant sky, put his hand on my shoulder affectionately. Well, that's enough. We will have no more of it. And indeed there was no more question of my mysterious vocation between us. There was to be no more question of it at all, nowhere with anyone. We began the descent of the fir coppice conversing merrily. 11 years later, month for month, I stood on Tower Hill on the steps of the St. Catherine's Dockhouse, a master in the British merchant service. But the man who put his hand on my shoulder at the top of the fir coppice was no longer living. That very year of our travels he took his degree of the philosophical faculty, and only then his true vocation declared itself. Obedient to the call he entered at once upon the 4-year course of the medical schools. A day came when, on the deck of a ship moored in Calcutta, I opened a letter telling me of the end of an enviable existence. He had made for himself a practice in some obscure little town of Austrian Galicia. And the letter? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.